People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos is brought to you by BunnySlippers.com, FoundItemClothing.com.
Keep cool this spring with rad shirts from your favorite cult classic films from FoundItemClothing.com.
People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos is brought to you by 01 Publishing. Check out some of their top titles: The Sadist Bible, Whispers from the Abyss, Volumes 1 and 2, Case File Arkham, and many more. Find out more about 01 by going to 01publishing.com. Since 2011, 01 Publishing has been dedicated to producing the best in speculative fiction across a wide variety of formats, including prose, graphic novels, and audio fiction. Thank you for joining us. This is the People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos, your guide to weird fiction, cosmic horror, and other strangeness. Join us as we explore the Cthulhu Mythos timeline from the start of time to the cooling of our sun. This is one of our readings. Join us next time for a full episode. You can help by donating a buck or five to paypal.me/pgttcm or donate monthly to patreon.com/pgttcm. Remember, you can follow the People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos at pgttcm.com and pgttcm.podbean.com. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at pgttcm. Hosted by D.B. Spitzer and Dame Madame Mortician.
The Chain of Aforgomon by Clark Ashton Smith. Weird Tales, December 1935. It is indeed strange that John Millwarp and his writings should have fallen so speedily into semi-oblivion. His books, treating of Oriental life in a somewhat flowery, romantic style, were popular a few months ago. But now, in spite of their range and penetration, their pervasive verbal sorcery, they are seldom mentioned, and they seem to have vanished unaccountably from the shelves of bookstores and libraries. Even the mystery of Millwarp's death, baffling to both law and science, has invoked but a passing interest, and excitement quickly lulled and forgotten. I was well acquainted with Millwarp over a term of years, but my recollection of the man is becoming strangely blurred, like an image in a misted mirror. His dark, half-alien personality, his preoccupation with the occult, his immense knowledge of Eastern life and lore are things I remember with such effort and vagueness as attends the recovery of a dream. Sometimes I almost doubt that he ever existed. It is as if the man and all that pertains to him were being erased from human record by some mysterious acceleration of the common process of obliteration. In his will, he appointed me his executor. I have vainly tried to interest publishers in the novel he left among his papers, a novel surely not inferior to anything he ever wrote. They said that his vogue has passed. Now I am publishing as a magazine story the contents of the diary kept by Millwarp for a period preceding his demise. Perhaps for the open-minded, his diary will explain the enigma of his death. It would seem that the circumstances of his death are virtually forgotten, and I repeat them here as part of my endeavor to revive and perpetuate Millwarp's memory. Millwarp had returned to his house in San Francisco after a long sojourn to Indochina. He who knew him gathered that he had gone into places seldom visited by Occidentals. At the time of his demise, he had just finished correcting the typescript of a novel which had dealt with the more romantic and mysterious aspects of Burma. On the morning of April 2nd, 1933, his housekeeper, a middle-aged woman, was startled by a glare of brilliant light which issued from the half-open door in Millwarp's study. It was as if the whole room were in flames. Horrified, the woman hastened to investigate. Entering the study, she saw her master sitting in an armchair at the table, wearing the rich, somber robes of Chinese brocade, which he affected as a dressing gown. He sat stiffly erect, a pen clutched unmoving in his fingers on the open page of a manuscript volume. About him in a sort of nimbus glowed and flickered the strange light, and her only thought was that his garments were on fire. She ran toward him, crying out a warning. At that moment, the weird nimbus brightened intolerably, and the wan early dayshine, the electric bulbs that still burned to attest the night's labor, were alike blotted out. It seemed to the housekeeper that something had gone wrong with the room itself, for the walls and tables vanished, and a great luminous gulf opened before her on the verge of the gulf, in a seat that was not his cushioned armchair, but a huge, rough-hewn seat of stone. She beheld her master stark and rigid. His heavy brocaded robes were gone, and about him, from head to foot, were blinding coils of pure white fire in the form of linked chains. She could not endure the brilliance of the chains and cowered back. She shielded her eyes with her hands. And when she dared to look again, the weird glowing had faded. The room was as usual, and Milwarp's motionless figure was seated at the table in the posture of writing. Shaken and terrified as she was, the woman found courage to approach her master. A hideous smell of burnt flesh arose from beneath his garments, which were wholly intact without visible trace of fire. He was dead, his fingers clutched on the pen and his features frozen in a stare of titanic agony. His neck and wrists were completely encircled with frightful burns that had charred them deeply. The coroner, in his examination, found these burns, preserving an outline of the heavy links, were extended in long, unbroken spirals around his arms, legs, and torso. The burning was apparently the cause of Milwarp's death. It was as if iron chains, heated to incandescence, had been wrapped about him. Small credit was given to the housekeeper's story of what she had seen. No one, however, could suggest an acceptable explanation of the bizarre mystery. There was, at the time, much aimless discussion. But, as I have hinted, people soon turned to other matters. The efforts made to solve the riddle were somewhat perfunctory. Chemists tried to determine the nature of a queer drug in the form of a gray powder with pearly granulates, to whose use Milwarp had become addicted. But their tests merely revealed the presence of an alkaloid whose source and attributes were obscure to Western science. Day to day, the whole incredible business lapsed from public attention, and those who had known Milwarp began to display the forgetfulness that was no less accountable than his weird doom. The housekeeper, who had held steadfastly in the beginning of her story, came at length to share the common dubity. Her account, her reputation, became vague and contradictory. Detail by detail, she seemed to forget the abnormal circumstances that she had witnessed with overwhelming horror. The manuscript volume in which Milwarp had apparently been writing at the time of his death was given into my charge with his other papers. It provided to be a diary, its last entry breaking off abruptly. Since reading the diary, I have hastened to transcribe it in my own hand, because, for some mysterious reason, the ink of the original is already fading and has become almost illegible in places. The reader will note lacuna due to passages written in an alphabet which neither I nor any scholar of my acquaintance can translate. These passages seem to form an integral part of the narrative, and they occur mainly towards the end, as if the writer had turned more and more to a language remembered from his ancient avatar. To the same mental reversion, one must attribute the singular dating, in which Milwarp, still enjoying English script, appears to pass from our contemporary notion to that of some pre-mundane world. I give hereunder the entire diary, which begins with an undated footnote. This book, unless I have been misinformed, concerns the qualities of the drug Sovara. We will begin the record of my former life in a lost cycle. I have had the drug in my possession for 7 months, but fear has prevented me from using it. Now, like certain tokens, I perceive that the longing for knowledge will soon overcome the fear. Ever since my Earliest childhood, I have been troubled by intimations, deep, unplaceable, that seemed to argue a forgotten existence. These intimations partook of the nature of feeling rather than ideas or images. They were like the wraiths of dead memories. In the backgrounds of my mind has lurked a sentiment of formless melancholy, desire for some nameless beauty long perished out of time, and, coincidentally, I have been haunted by an equally formless dread, an apprehension of some bygone but still imminent doom. Such feelings have persisted, undiminished, throughout my youth and maturity, but nowhere have I found any clue for their causation. My travels to the Mystic Orient, my delvings into occultism have merely convinced me of these shadow intuitions pertain to some incarnation buried under the wreck of remotest cycles. Many times in my wanderings through Buddhistic lands have I heard of the drug Sovara, which is believed to restore even the uninitiate the memory of other lives, and at last, after many vain efforts, I managed to procure a supply of the drug, the manner of which I obtained is a tale sufficiently remarkable in itself, but of no special relevance here. So far, perhaps, because of that apprehension which I have hinted, I have not dared to use the drug. March 9th, 1933. This morning I took the Sovara for the first time, dissolving the proper amount in pure distilled water, as I have been instructed to. Afterward, I leaned back easily in my chair, breathing with a slow, regular rhythm. I had no preconceived idea of the sensations that would mark the drug's initial effect, since these were said to vary prodigiously from the temperament of the users. But I composed myself to wait them with tranquility, after formulating clearly in my mind the purpose of the experiment. For a while, there was no change in my awareness. I noticed a slight quickening of the pulse and modulated my breathing in conformity with this. Then, by slow degrees, I experienced a sharpening of visual perception. The Chinese rugs on the floor, the backs of the serried volumes on my bookcases, and the very old wooden of the chairs, tables, and shelves began to exhibit new and unimagined colors. At the same time, there were curious alterations of outline, every object seeming to extend into a hitherto unsuspected fashion. Following this, my surroundings became semi-transparent, like molded shapes of mist. I found that I could see through the marbled cover of the illustrations in a volume of John Martin's edition of Paradise Lost, which lay before me on the table. All this, I knew, was a mere extension of ordinary physical vision. It was only a prelude to those apperceptions of occult realms which I sought through Sovara. Fixing my mind once more on the goal of the experiment, I became aware that the misty walls had vanished, like a dawn aras. About me, like reflections in rippled water, dim sceneries wavered and shifted, erasing one another from instant to instant. I seemed to hear a vague but ever-persistent sound, more musical than the murmurs of air, water, or fire, which was a property of the unknown element that environed me. With a sense of troublous familiarity, I beheld the blurred, unstable pictures which flowed past me upon the never-resting medium, Orient temples flashing with sunstruck bronze and gold, the sharp crowded gables of spires of medieval cities, tropic and northern forests, the costumes and the physiognomies of the Levant, of Persia, of old Rome and Carthage, went by like blown, flying mirages. Each succeeding tableau belonged to a more ancient period than the one before, and I knew that each was a scene from some former existence of my own. Still tethered, as it were, to my present self, I reviewed these visible memories, which took on tridimensional depth and clarity. I saw myself as a warrior and a troubadour, as a noble and a merchant and a mendicant. I trembled with dead fears and thrilled with lost hopes and raptures, and I was drawn by ties that death and Laith had broken. Yet never did I fully identify myself with those other avatars, for I knew well that the memory I sought pertained to some incantation of older epochs. Still, the phantasmagoria streamed on, and I turned giddy with the vertigo ineffable before the vastness of the end-eternity of the cycles of beginning. It seemed that I, the Watcher, was lost in a gray land where the homeless ghosts of all dead ages were fleeing from oblivion to oblivion. The walls of Nineveh, the columns and towers of unnamed cities, rose before me and were swept away. I saw the luxuriant plains that are now the Gobi Desert. The sea-lost capitals of Atlantis were drawn to the light of an unquenched glory. I gazed on lush and cloudy scenes from the first continents of Earth. Briefly, I relived the beginnings of terrestrial man and knew that the secret I would learn was ancienter even than these. Visions faded into black voidness, and yet in that void, through fathomless eons, it seemed that I existed like a blind atom in the space between the worlds. About me was the darkness and repose of that night which antedated the Earth's creation. Time flowed backwards with the silence of dreamless sleep.
Thanks again to BunnySlippers.com and FoundItemClothing.com for sponsoring this episode. People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos is brought to you by BunnySlippers.com, FoundItemClothing.com.
Keep cool this spring with rad shirts from your favorite cult classic films from FoundItemClothing.com.
Thanks again to Zero One Publishing for sponsoring this episode. Find out more by going to ZeroOnePublishing.com. People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos is brought to you by Zero One Publishing. Check out some of their top titles: The Sadist Bible, Whispers from the Abyss, Volumes 1 and 2, Case File Arkham, and many more. Find out more about Zero One by going to ZeroOnePublishing.com. Since 2011, Zero One Publishing has been dedicated to producing the best in speculative fiction across a wide variety of formats, including prose, graphic novels, and audio fiction.
The illumination, when it came, was instant and complete. I stood in the full fervid blaze of day, amid royally towering blossoms in a deep garden. Beyond those lofty, vine-clad walls where I heard the confused murmuring of the great city called Kalud. Above me, at their virile zenith, were the four small suns that illumined the planet Hestan. Jewel-colored insects fluttered about me, lighting without fear on the rich inhabitants of golden black, and wrought with astronomic symbols, in which I was attired. Beside me was a sundial-shaped altar of zoned agate, carved with the same symbols, which were those of the dreaded, omnipotent time god, Aphorm Gormon, whom I served as a priest. I had not even the slightest memory of myself as John Millwarp, and after a long pageant of my terrestrial lives was something that had never been, or was yet to be. Sorrow and desolation choked my heart as ashes filled some urn consecrated to the death. And all these hues and perfumes of the garden about me were redolent only of the bitterness of death. Gazing darkly upon the altar, I murmured blasphemy against Aphor Gormon, who in his inexplicable course had taken away my beloved and had sent no solace for my grief. Separately, I cursed the signs upon the altar, the stars, the worlds, the suns, the moons, that meted and fulfilled the process of time. Beltoris, my betrothed, had died at the end of the previous autumn, And so, with double maledictions, I cursed the stars and the planets presiding over that season. I had become aware that a shadow had fallen beside my own on the altar, and I knew that the Dark Sage and the sorcerer Atmox had obeyed my summons. Fearfully, but not without hope, I turned towards him, noting first of all that he bore under his arm a heavy, sinister-looking volume, with covers of black steel and hasps of adamant. Only when I made sure of this did I lift my eyes to his face, which was a little less somber and forbidding than the tome he carried. "Greetings, O Kalaspa," he said sharply. "I have come against my own will and judgment. The lore that you request is in this volume. And since you have saved me in your formal years from inquestrial wrath of the Time God's priests, I cannot refuse to share it with you. But understand, well, that even I, who have called upon the names that are dreadful to utter and have invoked forbidden presences, shall never dare to assist you in this conjuration. Gladly would I help you to hold converse with the shadow of Bellathoris, or even to animate her still unwithered body and draw it from the tomb. But that which you propose is another matter. You alone must perform the ordained rites, must speak the necessary words, for the consequences of this thing will be dire than you deem." "I do not care for the consequences," I replied eagerly. "If it is possible to bring back the lost hours which I shared with Bellathoris, think you that I could content myself with her shadow wandering thinly back from the borderland, or that I could take pleasure in the fair clay that the breath of necromancy has troubled and has made to arise and walk without mind or soul? Nay, the Bellathoris I would summon is she, on whom the shadow of death has never yet fallen." It seemed that Atmox, the master of doubtful arts, the vassal of Umbrage's powers, recoiled and blenched before my vehement declaration. "Bethink you," he said with minatory sternness, "that this thing will constitute a breach of the sacred logic of time and a blasphemy against Aforgomon, god of the minutes and the cycles. Moreover, there is little to be gained, for not in its entirety to bring back the season of your love, but only one single hour, torn from infinite violence from its rightful period of time. Refrain, I adjure you, and content yourself with a lesser sorcery." "Give me the book," I demanded. "My service to Aforgomon is forfeit. With due relevance and devotion, I have worshipped the Time God, and I have done in his honor the rites ordained from eternity. And for all this, the God has betrayed me. Then, in that high-climbing, luxuriant garden beside the four suns," Mox opened the adamite clasps of the steel-bound volume, and turning to a certain page, he laid the book reluctantly in my hands. The page, like it follows, of some unholy parchment streaked with musty discolorations and blackening at the margin with sheer antiquity, but upon it shone unquenchably the dread characters a primal age had written with a ink bright as the new shed ichors of demons. Above this page I bent in my madness, conning over and over it until I was dazzled by the fiery runes, and shutting my eyes, I saw them burn on a red darkness, still legible and writhing like hellish worms. Hollowly, like the sound of a far bell, I heard the voice of Atmox. "You have learned, O Kalaspa, the unutterable name of that one whose assistance can alone restore the fled hours. And you have learned the incantation that will rouse that hidden power, and the sacrifice needed for its propitiation. Knowing these things, is your heart still strong and your purpose firm? The name I have read in the wizard volume was that of the chief cosmic power antagonistic to Aforgomon. The incantation and the required offering were those of a foul demonolatry. Nevertheless, I did not hesitate, and gave resolute affirmative answer to the somber query of Atmox. Perceiving that I was inflexible, he bowed his head, trying no more to dissuade me than as the flame-ruined volume had bade me to. I defiled the altar of Aforgomon, and blotting certain of its prime symbols with dust and spittle, while Atmox looked up in silence, I wounded my right arm to its deepest vein on the sharp-tipped gnomon of the dial, and let the blood drip from zone to zone, orb to orb of the graven agate. I made unlawful sacrifice, and intoned aloud, in the name of the lurking chaos, Zazanoth, and in the name of the lurking chaos, Zazanoth, abominable ritual composed by a backward repetition and jumbling of litanies sacred to the time god. Even as I chanted the incantation, it seemed that the webs of shadow were woven fully athwart the suns, and the ground shook a little, as if colossal demons trod the world's rim, striding stupendously from abysses beyond. The garden walls and trees wavered in a wind-blown reflection in a pool, and I grew faint with the loss of that lifeblood I had poured out in the demonolatrous offering. Then, my flesh and in my brain, I felt the intolerable racking of a vibration like a long-drawn shock of cities riven by earthquake, and coasts crumbling before some chaotic sea. And my flesh was torn and harrowed, and my brain shuddered with the toneless discord sweeping me through from the deep to deep. I faltered, and conclusion gnawed at my inmost being. Dimly, I heard the prompting of Atmox, and dimmer still was the sound of my own voice that made me answer to Zazanoth, naming the impious necromancy which was to be effected only through its power. Madly, I implored Zazanoth, in despite of time and its ordered seasons, 1 hour of that begone autumn which I had shared with Belathoris, and employing this, I named no special hour, for all in memory had seemed of an equal joy and gladness. As these words ceased upon my lips, I thought as the darkness fluttered in the air like a giant wing, and the 4 suns went out, and my heart was stilled as if in death, falling obliquely from the sun's mellow and full-tided autumn, and nowhere beside me was there any shadow of Atmox, and the altar of zoned agate was bloodless and undefiled. I, the lover of Belathoris, witting not of the doom and sorrow to come, stood happily from my beloved before the altar, and saw her young hands crown its ancient dial with the flowers we had plucked from the garden. Dreadful beyond all fathoming are the mysteries of time. Even I, the priest and initiate, thought wise in the secret doctrines of Aforgomon. Now little enough of that elusive, ineluctable process whereby the present becomes the past and the future revolves into the present. All men have pondered the riddles of duration and transcendence, have wondered vainly to what bourne the lost days and sped cycles are consigned. Some have dreamt that the past abides unchanged, becoming eternity as it slips from our mortal ken. And others have deemed that time is a stairway whose steps crumble one by one behind the climber, falling into a gulf of nothing. However this may be, I know that she who stood beside me was Belathoris, on whom no shadow of mortality had yet been descended. The hour was one newborn, and not knowing the events future to that hour. But returning to the present, they recalled with amazement an unnatural necromancy, and fear and bewilderment were upon them, and none could interpret its meaning. For a brief period, the dead had lived again. The fallen leaves had returned to their bough. The heavenly bodies had stood at a long-abandoned station. The flowers had gone back into the seed, the plant into the root, and the eternal disorder set among then, with eternal disorder set among all its cycles, time had resumed its delayed course. No movement of any cosmic body, no year of instant of that future, would be precisely as it should have been. The error and discrepancy it had wrought would bear fruit in ways innumerable. The suns would find themselves at fault. The worlds and atoms would go always a little astray from their appointed bournes. It was these matters that Atmok spoke, warning me after he had staunched my bleeding wound. For he too, in that relumiated hour, had gone back and had lived again through a past happening. For him, the hour was one in which he had descended into the nether vaults of his house, there standing in a many-pentacled circle, with burning of unholy incense and uttering of accursed formulae. He called upon a malign spirit from the bowels of Hastan, and he had questioned it concerning the future. But the spirit, black and voluminous as the fumes of pitch, refused to answer him directly, and pressed furiously with its clawed members against the confines of the circle. It said,
"Thou hast summoned me at thy peril. Potent are the spells thou hast used, and strong is the circle to withstand me. But I am restrained by time and space from the wrecking of my anger upon thee. But happily thou shalt summon me again, albeit in the same hour and the same autumn, and in that summoning the laws of time shall be broken, and a rift shall be made in space, and through the rift, though with some delay and divagation, I shall win thee."
Say no more. It prowled restlessly about the circle, and its eyes burned down on Antimox like embers in a high-lifed sooty brazier, and ever and anon its fanged mouth was flattened on the spell-deafened air, and in the end, he could dismiss it only after a double repetition from the form of exorcism. As he told me this tale in his garden, Atmox trembled, and his eyes searched the narrow shadows wrought by the high suns, and he seemed to listen for the noise of some evil thing that burrowed toward them beneath the earth. Fourth day of the moon oscillat, stricken with terrors beyond those of Atmox. I keep apart in my mansion amid the city of Kalud. I was still weak with the loss of blood I had yielded to Zazanoth. My senses were full of strange shadows. My servitors, coming and going about me, were as phantoms, and scarcely I heeded the pale fear in their eyes or heard the dreadful things they whispered. Madness and chaos, they told me, were abroad in Kalud. The divinity of Aphormgoman was angered. All men thought that some baleful doom impended because of the unnatural confusion which had been wrought among the hours of time. This afternoon, they brought me the story of Atmok's death. In bated tones, they told me how his neophytes had heard a roaring as of a loosened tempest in the chamber where he sat alone with his wizard volumes and paraphernalia. Above the roaring, for a little, human screams had sounded, together with a dashing as of hurried censers and braziers, and a crashing of overturned tables and tone. Blood riled from under the shut door of the chamber, and riling. It took from instant to instant to the form of dire ciphers that spelt an unspeakable name. After the noises ceased, the neophytes waited a long time ere they dared to open the door. Entering at last, they saw the floor and the walls heavily bespattered with blood, and rags of the sorcerer's remained mingled everywhere with the sheets of his torn volumes of magic, and the shreds and manglings of his flesh strewn amid broken furniture, and his brains daubed in a horrible paste on the high ceiling. Hearing this tale, I knew that the earthly demon feared by Atmox had found him somehow, and had wreaked its wrath upon him. In ways unguessable, it had reached him through the chasm made in ordered time and space by 1 hour repeated through necromancy. And because of that lawless chasm, the magician's power and lore had utterly failed to defend him from the demon. Fifth day of the moon oscillat. Antrox, I'm sure, had not betrayed me, for in doing so, he must have betrayed his own implicit share in my crime. Howbeit, this evening the priests came to my house ere the setting of the westernmost sun, silent, grim, with eyes averted as if from a foulness inimitable. Me, their fellow, they had enjoined with loth gestures to accompany them. Thus they took me from my house and along the thoroughfares of Kalu toward the lowering suns. The streets were empty of all other passengers, and it seemed that no man desired to meet or behold the blasphemer. Down the avenue of gnomon-shaped pillars, I was led to the portals of Afor Goman's fane. Those awful gaping portals arched in the likeness of some devouring chimera's mouth. The sixth day of the moon of Ocelot. They had thrust me into the obulette beneath the temple. Dark and noisome, and soundless except for the maddening, measured drip of water beside me. There I lay, and know not where the night passed and the morning came. Light admitted only when my captors opened the iron door, coming to lead me before the tribunal. Thus priests condemned me, speaking with one voice, and whose dreadful volume the tones were all indistinguishably blended. Then the high age priest, Helpinar, called upon Afor Gorman, offering himself as a mouthpiece to the god, and asking the god to pronounce through him the doom that was acceptable for such enormalities as those which I had been judged guilty by my fellows. Instantly, it seemed, the god descended into Helpinar, and the figure of the high priest appeared to dilate prodigiously beneath his mufflings, and the accents that issued from his mouth were like thunders of the upper.
Thou hast set disorder amid all future hours and eons through this evil necromancy. Thereby, moreover, thou hast wrought thine own doom. Fettered art thou forever to the hours thus unlawfully repeated, apart from its due place and time. According to hieratic rule, thou shalt meet the death of the fiery chains. But deem not its death is more than a symbol of the true punishment. Thou shalt pass hereafter through other lives in Hestan, and thou shalt climb midway in the cycles of the world subsequent to Hestan in time and space. But through all thine incarnations, the chaos thou hast invoked will attend thee widening ever like a rift. And always, in all thy lives, thy rift shall bar thee from reunion with the soul of Belisarius. And always, through nearly an hour, thou shalt miss the love that should otherwise have been oftentimes regained. At last, when the chasm has widened over so much, thy soul shall fare no further in the onward cycles of incarnation. At that time, it shall be given thee to remember clearly thine ancient sin, and remembering, thou shalt persist out of time. Upon the body of that later life shall be found the charred imprint of the chains, as the final token of thy bondage. But they that knew thee will soon forget, and thou shalt belong wholly to the cycles limited for thee by the sin.
March 29th. I write this date with infinite desperation, trying to convince myself that there is a John Millthorpe who exists on Earth in the 20th century. For 2 days running, I have not taken the drug Solvara, and yet I have returned twice to that obulet in Afor Goman's temple, in which the priest Calaspa awaits his doom. Twice I have been immersed in its stagnant darkness, hearing the slow drip of water beside me, like a clepsydra that tells the black ages of the damned. Even as I write this at my library's table, it seems that an ancient midnight plucks at the lamp. The bookcases turn the walls of oozing night and stone. There is no longer a table, nor one who writes, as I breathe the noisome dankness of a dungeon lying unfathomed by any sun in a lost world. 18th day of the moon, Ocelot. Today, for the last time, they took me from my prison. Pelpenor, together with three others, came and led me to the Etidum of the god. Far beneath the outer temple, we went. Through the spacious crypts unknown to the common worshippers, there was no word spoken, no glance exchanged between the others and me. It seemed that they had already regarded me as one cast out from time and claimed by oblivion. We came ultimately to that sheer falling gulf in which the spirit of Afor Goman is said to dwell. Lights, feeble and far scattered, shone around in the stars on the rim of cosmic vastness, shedding no rays into the depths. There is a seat of hewn stone overhanging the frightful verge. I was placed by the executioners, and a ponderous chain of black unrusted metal strapped to a solid rock was wound about me, circling my naked body and separate limbs from head to foot. To this doom, others have been condemned for heresy or impiety, though never for such a sin as mine. After the chaining of the victim, he was left for a stated interim to ponder his crime, and happily to confront the dark divinity of Afor Goman. At length, from the abyss into which his position forced him to peer, a light would dawn, and a bolt of strange flame would leap upward, striking the many-coiled chain about him and heating it instantly to the whiteness of incandescent iron. The source and the nature of the flame were mysterious, and many ascribed it to the god himself rather than to mortal agency. Even thus they have left me and have gone away, long since the burden of the massy links cutting deeper and deeper into my flesh has become an agony. I am dizzy and gazing downward into the abyss, and yet I cannot fall. Beneath, immeasurably beneath, at current intervals, I hear a hollow and solemn sound. Perhaps it is the sigh of sunken waters, or cavern strain of winds, or the respiration of one that abides in the darkness, melting his breath with the slow minutes, hours, days, the ages. My terror has become heavier than the chain. My vertigo is born of a twofold gulf. Eons have passed by, all the worlds have ebbed into nothingness, like wreckage borne onto a chasm-falling stream, taking with them the lost face of Belatharis. I am posed above the gaping maw of the shadow. Somehow, in another world, an exiled phantom has written these words. A phantom who must fade utterly from time and place, even as I, the doomed priest Kalispa. I cannot remember the name of the phantom. Beneath me, in the black depths, there is an awful brightening. That was The Chains of Afor Goman by Clark Ashton Smith. Weird Tales, December 1935.
Thank you for listening to The People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. Join us next time when we talk about weird fiction, horror, or any number of topics. Join the discussion on Facebook or Twitter. And remember to rate, review, and subscribe to PGTTCM on iTunes and Stitcher or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Book reviews, film recommendations, and much more. People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos is edited and produced by DB Spitzer, written by Daniel Spitzer and Christina Wright. Hosted by Dedame Madam Mortician and DB Spitzer. Music by Kevin MacLeod. People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Find some great podcasts and learn more by going to darkmyths.org. Remember to stay squiggly and keep it weird.
If you hear this before the end of April, check out DB Spitzer on blurryphotos.com on their Bolstone episode for April 2017. Thank you so much for listening to People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. And remember, We love to hear from you. If you have a story, if you have any items, if you have anything you want to tell us, show us, whatever, that's great. Yeah, short stories, poems, whatever. Well, if you read a story that's in the public domain that would fit on this show, we'll put it on the show. And we'll plug whoever you want to talk about. If you have a story that you wrote that's original, we'll plug it. But you've got to record it, because we don't want to record everything. Because, you know, hey, we got enough stuff that we're recording, these readings and stuff like that, yeah. And hey, if you want to help out, show some, I don't know, appreciation, say, hey, good job, whatever, you can go to patreon.com. Actually, don't go to Patreon, that's a pain in the ass. Go to paypal.me/PGTTCM. Donate a buck or five. I really don't. You know, I don't want you to, like, donate a bunch of money, just some. You don't even have to do that. Just listen and tell your friends to listen. Maybe some of them have money and maybe they'll throw in something. And we've got the store at society6.com, but you can just find the link for that on pgttcm.com. And we're going to be redoing the store totally, and we're going to be starting up something of a sticker club, but, you know, there'll be t-shirts and there will be posters, but it'll be a sticker club, and who knows, we're gonna do some stuff. There might be a YouTube channel, there might be a spinoff, who knows, future plans, future actions.